Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
So hi, these days, like many of us, my life is pretty simple. Work, home, zazen, and taking care of my grandchild, William. And it has led me to thinking a little bit more about our lives in general. By observing my grandson, I see, you know, firsthand that we are born helpless, needing everything done for us. But at the same time, at that time, our view is very wide. We see everything, you know, a change of shade in the light is a thing, right? A sound is a thing, even if it's a lawnmower or a car driving by, it's a thing. A bird flying overhead is a thing. And so we have this unlimited view of perception because we have very little interpretation or no interpretation, ability to interpret. And also we can do very little. We need everything done for us. We need to be fed, changed, clothed, put to sleep. Even we can't do anything for ourselves. As we grow, we learn to speak, to do simple tasks like walking. And as we gain control over our bodies and our minds, we increase certain pathways in our brain and behavior and lose others. There's an innocence that even a young age of one begins to notice is lost. Awareness now begins to be targeted to what people are saying and trying to understand what they're saying and repeat it. Some of those spontaneous reflexes are already going by the wayside. The process of socialization has begun. The baby looks to the parents to see if it's okay to do something. Touch something. We are gradually socialized into what is considered appropriate and inappropriate behavior for our society. We learn to fit in. Later, we choose some profession or trade, or perhaps, and execute our functions in society while we tend to our families. We may experience some difficulties with this, perhaps, requiring all of our energies at times, while at other times it may be more relaxed. Anybody wants to have a fun thing, you can watch Don Hoffman with his evolutionary theory and the mathematics of evolution and how it selects for us to our behaviors and hones down our behaviors that have reproductive value. Later in old age, we experience gradual waning of our capacities, even while we experience a wider perspective. As my husband likes to say, if only I could have the mind of now and be 28 again. But that's the whole point, isn't it? At any point in this path, we may experience severe difficulties, illness, or other unexpected problems. Our conventional egos, the set of functions developed in those early developmental years, assist us in navigating many of the difficulties encountered along this path of life. They help us to know when to advance, when to retreat, help us to interpret relationships around us and work through complicated situations. They help us to understand many of the whys in our lives. But there are some whys that are more complicated. Why did I or someone I love get sick? Why are we suffering a pandemic? Why did she leave me? Why doesn't he love me? The mind is wired to ask incessantly the whys, seeking to establish some solution or some path out of the difficult parts of our lives, because that is what it is trained to do. Find a cause, a reason, and go about fixing it. But the difficult things in our lives defy this why. They are much bigger. They require a bigger answer. And that is where the spiritual traditions often come in. Now, spirituality is sometimes defined as the search for meaning and a sense of connection to something bigger than ourselves. Or as Les described it in his last book, a sense of something greater. Including the major religions, as well as many theories and philosophical paths, meaning is hard to understand using the conventional thinking methods. Beyond the securing of resources, the satisfaction of needs, and the coming to terms with our strong emotions. All humans feel this deep discomfort, sense of loss in the face of illness or death, sense of separation, looking for a deeper meaning explanation, and looking to feel a deeper rhythm that helps us to make sense of our lives and attain or reestablish an equilibrium. Buddha developed his answer to this quest, and he described it as the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. He emphasized meditation and a contemplative simple life of the monks and nuns who followed his instructions. He described the doctrine of no self or anatman, no fixed or underlying unchanging self, a fluidity to experience that he described as interdependent origination, leading to the continuous evolution of events and being. Out of that early teaching developed Zen, clothed in Chinese tradition, and later putting on a Japanese garb, later to be brought to the U.S., The character for Zen in Chinese, Chan, on the left is a radical indicating spirit. On the right is part of how the word is said, indicating simplicity. Together, one might interpret the character to mean simple spirit. And in many ways, Zen teachings have been just that. Zen monks have traditionally followed a rather simple life, one that emphasizes meditation rather than relying on texts and sutras. The lifestyle in Zen monasteries has often relied on minimal resources, and Zen monks emphasize growing their own food and not relying on external sources such as donations. This proved to them quite helpful during the time of the An Lushan Rebellion, when in China, very quickly, within the space of less than a year, basically changed from a very prosperous country to one that was ravaged by famine and suffering. As Dufu, a contemporary of Sekito Kisen and Baso Doitsu, said, "The nation is destroyed. Mountains and rivers remain." So our two of well-known Zen teachers, one who founded the Soto Zen tradition and one who founded the Rinzai tradition later in Japan, in China were known as Baso Doitsu or Mazu Daoyi. And the other one is Shito Shichen. They were Chan teachers around the time of the An Lushan Rebellion. We often think of them as having an easy life, but in fact, it was quite challenging. And one of the reasons that many Zen monasteries were not reached for destruction during the time of An Lushan Rebellion, when between 13 and 36 million people were killed, which is described in some places, it's 2 out of 3 of the three people in the population of China, were that they were in the mountains, and that they were often very self-sufficient. Until then, until the time of Shi Tou and Ma Zu, Chan was largely an introspective meditation practice. You looked inward to find your true self. And this is, I'm quoting here from a Lion's Roar publication by Joan Sutherland back in November of 2020. Huineng, for example, described meditation as clearly seeing your original nature inside yourself. Shi Tou and Ma raised the eyes of Chan to the horizon. In Shi Tou's words, what meets the eye is the way. This true self you are looking for, they said, is not just here in your own heart mind, but everywhere. Everything you see is Buddha nature. Everything shines with that light. Everything you see is you. And this at a time when what you saw included refugees starving by the roadside, deserted towns, parents mourning their children killed in the wars. There is something moving about the large and generous spirit of these two men who responded to the devastation around them by saying, "This is all me, this is all you." They showed that the way to come to terms with life's pain is not by turning away from them, but by moving deeper into life and encouraging as many others as possible to join you. They embraced the great matter of their time. What do we do now? We 1 in 3 who survive. The Zen practitioners of ancient times emphasized reliance on an embodied practice, one that went beyond conventional rational explanations of why or wherefore, and sought to provide answers that evolved out of the deeper elements of our human experience, touch those deeper rhythms of our lives that are expressed in our being. Later in 13th century Japan, Dogen emphasized the importance of the monastery head cook, who cared for all the beings of the monks, all for the well-beings of the monks by preparing food mindfully and fully engaged. He wrote a book entitled Instructions for the Cook. While most of us don't have to run a monastery, many of us have to negotiate complex lives involving caring for many people. We may use this manual to cook our lives, so to speak. A few of the lessons from this text include choosing the very best ingredients that are available and as much as possible wasting nothing, cooking them with extreme attention and mindfulness, regarding every aspect of our lives as practice, making no discriminations. Taking care to maintain the mind of Buddha through every minute. Not forgetting anyone. Not getting attached to a fixed or rigid idea of self, but allowing the fluidity and needs of the moment to guide us. Parental mind. Striving to maintain a spirit of joy and equanimity, or magnanimity is how they translate it. So, and Dogen also, you know, one of the things that we think of him as being so influential in Kamakura, Japan, but actually at the time, he was a rather small player on the field of Buddhism and retreated to Mount Hiei to conduct his teachings and his activities. And even though he did visit the shogunate, but he was not at that time revered in Buddhism. And that only came much later. So in a sense, we remember him as having started in Kamakura, Japan, but we have to remember that he himself was in a context and was just like the early Zen monks early Buddhism in the Tang Dynasty, a relatively small player in a complex field of activity. So what about now? So while we run our regular lives and must take care of the children getting on Zoom for their morning classes, while we arrive at work in the next room, can we also take care of the simple spirit of our lives? Can we acknowledge and give some time to those deeper rhythms that help us to tune into ourselves, into nature, and the universe of experience around us? It's a question. I don't have the answer. I'll leave you with a little poem. There is no why to the moon peeking between the clouds in the sky, to the sound of the planes in the quiet evening, as they begin to make their way again after a long pause, the smell of flowers blooming. That's it. Thank you.
Dave, you have a question?
Yeah, just real quickly, Brenda, I was curious about what you said about Dogen. And I wasn't sure whether you were saying, when you said his fame came much later, was this actually during his life, or was he still an obscure sort of sideshow in Buddhism in Japan at the time, for example, he founded a Heiji and so forth? I'd never heard before what you said about what it was like for him, at least early in his life.
You know, I'm not a Japanese scholar, but just from a little bit of my reading, you know, he wasn't unknown. He was kind of a little bit of a newbie. You know, he did have favor with the shogunate, and they called him to build a temple in Kamakura. And later his teaching was adopted, you know, in terms of sort of training the sort of the militaristic aspect of what became, you know, later development of the shogunate. So training samurai and so forth. But at that time, he was still experimental. Now he wasn't the well established. He was a little bit alternative. Is my perception. There's a book I came across in my research for this. It's by Richard Payne. It's called Revisioning Kamakura Buddhism by Richard Payne. He describes this in more detail.
Interesting. So it sounds like he was, to make a rough analogy, sort of the Nikolai Tesla of Zen, in the sense that he's now regarded as a serious contributor, but he was sort of an oddball in left field during his life.
At the time, yeah.
Interesting. Thank you.
Brenda, you were talking about the rebellion that was occurring in China. Can you, what time period was this, or what century was this?
Anushan is in the 13? So the Anushan Rebellion happened around where Sekito Kisen, so that was 750s,
oh, wow,
around thereabouts. And there were a few different big blows to Buddhism around that time. So that one, what happened actually, it was a blow to the whole Chinese society, mm-hmm, where An Lushan basically conducted, or he was a warrior himself, and conducted a large scale revolt and destroyed many temples. And then subsequent to that, about there was another big a blow to Buddhism, the Hui Cheng crap, you know. So what he did in order to kind of stabilize himself, he allowed many people to actually join and become monks and excuse them from taxation after he took over and killed millions of people, right? And so it became basically a tax haven to become a monk. And so many people joined the monkhood. And then that became a problem. So about in the 850s or so, then there was the Hui Cheng crackdown on Buddhism, where they said, everybody go back home and start paying taxes. And that's when, again, Zen Buddhists benefited by the fact that they were in the mountains and minding their own business, mm-hmm, and did not have a large presence in the cities. So then many thousands of monks and were many thousands of monks were killed and many monasteries destroyed. And some people say that Buddhism never recovered in China from that blow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually described in a book by Enin, who was a Japanese monk who traveled to China during that time. He was just trying to learn some Buddhism, and he ended up there just the wrong time. He managed to get out alive and get back to Japan, and he wrote a diary, Enin's diaries.
Uh-huh. Wow, interesting. Yeah.
Very, very, very interesting.
So this was this during the Tang Dynasty? I'm trying to think.
This was during the Tang Dynasty. Okay. Yeah, wow. Yeah. The high, you know, that was the high point of Buddhism in China. Yeah, it was a flowering dynasty in Chang'an and Xi'an, the modern day Xi'an. It was
interesting.
The highest probably culture civilization on the planet at that time.
Yeah. Hi, Brenda. Thank you for your talk.
Hi, Teresa.
I like the poem. Are you the author?
I am.
I love if you could read it again. I always find it helpful if people read the poems twice because, you know, they're short and fast and I cannot really. And then I have a question after you read it.
Okay, so I'll read it. Yeah, I like to take a walk in the evenings. That's been one of my new things. And so this has happened in a while. There is no why. To the moon peeking between the clouds in the sky, to the sound of the planes in the quiet evening, as they begin to make their way again after a long pause, the smell of flowers blooming.
Thank you, it's beautiful, thanks. Yeah, I love to start seeing the planes on the sky again. My question is about the title of your talk. You said it's a simple life, right? The title. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what is a simple life? What you describe at the end about connecting with more with nature or what is a simple life? And I think in your talk a few times you thought about navigating complex situations in our, you know, modern lives. So
right.
How do we have a simple life? I think there are two questions. What is simple life? How do we have a simple life in this complex modern world? Thank you.
Well, I guess we look to our Zen tradition, whereas one helps us inform that, you know, in terms of what are our true needs. You know, we need to sleep. We're pretty useless without sleep. I know I am, right? And we need to eat a little bit. We need to have some friends. I at least do better when I meditate. You don't want to see me when I don't meditate too much. I would say the last thing I would say is to kind of try to stay soft and flexible in our lives, like, you know, sort of like a bamboo. It's sort of my image all the time, you know, is kind of just, you know, when you come up with a position, is this really necessary? You know, sometimes it is. Sometimes it is. Sometimes your feelings are very strong and you need to stick up for something that you feel is unjust, you know? And I think that's part of being alive. And especially now with some of the things that are going on with, you know, anti-cultural actions, anti-racist actions, just injustices. You know, we need to speak out, and not to speak out is in itself an action, you know. So it doesn't mean to not care about what's going on around us and not helping people when we can. I think that's an essential part of keeping that life simple. But not worrying about things like status and fame and, you know, being right, things like that. That's what I would say. Anybody else have any suggestions?
Hello, Brenda.
Hi, Giuseppe.
Teresa. Yes, it's, I also noticed, like Teresa, this point in your talk, central point in your talk, I sensed in your words a little bit of a reflection on life, on being, you know, yourself, and with some appreciation for your life as it is, so to speak, which was very nice to hear as a teaching, and so simple life. I would like to hear a little bit from you more on simple life in the sense of is it simple life meaning, because I'm also struggling with simple life since some time, is it really making it practically simpler, as you said, like as we feel the need for maybe less clutter, less busyness, or, you know, there is a limit to that, to what you can really do, and maybe the original meaning was something that is coming from your words tonight, that is more like simply living or simply being yourself, whether it's a complex situation or not. Maybe I myself get myself in very complex situations, but then just being oneself in the situation. I don't know. It's difficult to describe maybe how, but what do you have thoughts about it? Did I pick up something that was in your mind? In your talk.
Yeah. I think that's right, Giuseppe. I think being simply yourself. I like that. I think that's exactly right. And you can ask yourself that. Am I being simply myself? I mean, sometimes, you know, being simply yourself can lead to some somewhat unskillful action. So it can hurt somebody, you know. So it does help to kind of, you know, just consider that question. Is it really necessary to say what I'm about to say? I think, you know, what we know and our knowledge is not necessarily, we shouldn't forget everything, but I think not be bound by, you know, we're limited by our theories and our, you know, our knowledge. Be able to let go of it and just be. This is where sometimes, like, they talk about, you know, like a little child, right? If you have children, so you can observe how they are very natural and spontaneous. And I think we're all like that in the inside.
Brenda.
Hello, David.
In your conception or in your experience of your own simple life, can you describe the proper amount? I hate to sound like a recipe, but what role does suffering play in successfully leading a simple life? Four Noble Truths kind of suffering.
Role does suffering play? I guess.
I could elaborate on background if you wish, but.
Yeah, tell me more.
This came out of a very sincere discussion in a 12-step group where the idea came up that I want to stop craving alcohol, for instance. And it took a Buddhist turn in the sense of, I don't think the promise to end suffering meant to turn off craving and unhappiness kind of things. It never goes to zero. And the poor fellow was very upset with that interpretation of things. He really wanted to make it go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess my take on that is that there's some psychological science behind that also is what I'm saying. So it's not all just my interpretation. Is that accepting the existence of the craving is actually the way to go. Going, I'm going to accept that I will still crave alcohol, but I will not engage in that behavior. And that actually accepting of that suffering, essentially, accepting of that suffering gives you the needed leverage to continue in the behavior of not engaging in it. Where actually if you want it to go away, it just makes it stronger. It strengthens that the grip it has on you. So by saying, you know, it's there. Yeah, not gonna worry about it too much. Mm-hmm. Then actually it actually weakens that link in our brains.
So that person's version of a simple life would have to accept the complication of constant craving.
Yes.
Life would be simpler without this craving, right? Sure.
Yes, it would. But if you simply accept it,
it ain't gonna happen.
It may not happen. Not for a while. Not for a while. You know, I think that nothing lasts forever, even cravings.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even cravings don't last forever. We know that. You can actually show them. You can actually monitor them. They'll hit a peak and then they'll subside. And eventually they will get lower over time. It may not go away completely if somebody has been, you know. But I think accepting, that's the suffering. Accepting the suffering. And that's what I talked about. Life is suffering, you know. Accepting that piece of suffering. But we can have control over our actions.
Thank you.
Hi, Brenda. Thank you for your talk.
Hi, Nick.
So as you were talking about what is simple life, what is complex life, I found myself asking myself the question, when did I ever feel my life was simple and when did I feel it was complex? And I have to say the only times in my life I've ever truly felt that things were simple was actually when I'm on retreat. And, you know, when you're on retreat, when you're on session, something very special happens towards the end of it. And it's just, it really is the complete dropping away of mind and body. And there's something very special about that short period of time that you live in community. And you don't have to talk about anything. You don't have to explain anything. Everyone has their function and you give everything to the Sangha and the Sangha gives everything to you. And I found myself kind of asking, why do I feel my practice is so stagnant right now during this pandemic? And I think it's because all of us missed out on the opportunity to go on retreat this past year to, you know, essentially do the best that a lay person can do in terms of home leaving. You know, it's become virtually impossible in this day and age for us to do what the Buddha did and the first Sangha did, to leave home and live in community and do only practice. And so, you know, I'm asking, you know, how can I mitigate the complexities of this modern life that you know, this is the world we're born into, but at the same time, nurture the practice to the extent that the Buddha had taught us to do. And I don't know. I don't really see that for us as lay people, we can really do that unless there is that home leaving. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but I guess maybe the way that I think about it is I look at, like, you know, the Olympic athletes, they've mastered their craft, that it's become very easy for them to do what is considered impossible. But that's after, like, countless hours of very, very intense practice. It only became easy after extreme hardship and trial and putting yourself into your practice. So, you know, maybe that's an oversimplified analogy for our Zen practice, but I don't know if you see it that way or what. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah. Thank you for your question. That's a wonderful question. I think, and I think it is, you know, very much a question very germane to our time at this point in Buddhism in America, in terms of, you know, is it a practice for the masses, or is it a practice for those select few who can do that, you know, who can go to the mountains in a retreat, whose life conditions permits them to do that. So I would say that, you know, my personal opinion is that, you know, if you look at the flow of Buddhism, where it started with monks living fully, you know, separated lives in monasteries their whole life, you know, begging for a living, and then move over to Japan, I mean, to China, where they were kind of farming, you know, move over to times where they, you know, in the current world, they have some jobs. I think the flow of consciousness is towards us being less concrete with the location of our home leaving and really realizing that the homes we are leaving are the conventional thinking of our own minds. That I would argue that home leaving isn't some abstract leaving your home. It can be closing the door, you know, and that we need to be more fluid in how we understand some of those conventional Buddhist teachings, if they really are meant for everyone. If, as a bodhisattva, all people need to reach enlightenment, they can't all go, this is conversations that I've sometimes had, they can't all go to Tassajara. You know, we can't, many of them may not be able to even go to a Zen center, you know? So if Zen teaching is really for everyone, then we need to identify what it is and practice those things. And they really involve that turning of the mind, you know, the dhyana, right? What is that? What is that really, right? What is it? What is happening there? And you're turning the mind away from that external, I got to do this. I got to take care of this. I have to have some of this and some of that. And I got to get this person to do what I want him to do. And right, that whole game that we all play, check that email. So it's stepping back. It's that stepping back into yourself. That's the essential thing. And that doing that again and again and again and again. And yes, it's great to be able to go on retreat, to really anchor that down in our beings. And yes, it's great to be able to go, you know, for months at a time and anchor it even more deeply. And I think, but the work of every day, whether you're in retreat or out of retreat, is no different. It's coming back. You could be in a retreat, and I've talked to people who've been in long retreats, and all they think about is that piece of chocolate that they're going to get, you know, that's in the mail for them. And they're not, you know, are they anchored in themselves? I'm not sure, you know. So I think that challenge, it's just like, where was David talking about the craving, right? The craving for the alcohol. We all are in the same boat. We're all 12 steps, okay? We want that craving. So it's how do you relate to that craving for something more? Whether it's that extra cup of tea when you're on a retreat or that extra bonus at the end of the year. It's, can you come back to yourself? Can you come back to your simple nature of your breath, of your being in your body on your cushion? I think that's the essence to me of leaving home. And doing that again and again in the world and out of it.
Yeah, just a quick observation based on what Nick said and David, and going back to, I think, what Giuseppe was getting at about simplicity in our lives. Certainly, we all recognize in our practice that it's very important not to drag needless complexity into our lives. But at the same time, it's important not to just be in denial about the complexity that we are facing and the difficulties we're facing. And there's a wonderful, very simple little quote that I just find I return to over and over again in my life, which is from Albert Einstein, who said, "Things should be made as simple as possible, but no simpler."
Hi, hi. Hi.
Hey, Brenda.
Hi, Omar.
So, just a few comments about what Nick had said. So one thing is, Sasheen is not about going away from home. It's actually coming home. Number one, that's how I see it. And number two was, Doris Day always used to say, it's never impossible. If you look at the word actually says, I am possible. I'm possible. So that's another way of looking at it. So it just depends on how you look at the word. Third thing I wanted to say was, suffering comes, a lot of suffering comes from desire. And, I can attest to that because sometimes for the past 3 weeks, I've been trying to cut down on my sugar and my chocolate because I'd eaten so much that my gout got inflamed and it was very painful. So it's almost like, desire tells me, okay, go ahead, eat as much chocolate as you want. And, the pain says, okay, sucker, I'm going to get you for this, what came out of this is the whole idea of compassion, which is really comes down to a vision and having empathy. And what it is that it depends on what kind of vision, it's a choice. What kind of vision do I want? Do I want a vision which is full of pain and discomfort, or do I want a vision that is of not having pain, so that I can go about taking care of everything in my life and those around me? And that, to me, has become a much better sort of a guide to understand that, this is what it's really about, or this is what our practice is about, that we don't want to take, things are important. We do need to eat things, but there is a reason why the Buddha said the middle road is the best way to go about doing things, so we don't cause ourselves pain, so that we are available for ourselves and other people in this world, right? So it's just when you brought up Simple Life, and I was thinking, yeah, the Simple Life is really about compassion, and this is what compassion to me recently has been. Is that having a vision for myself, having a vision for and empathy for myself, and having a vision and empathy for other people. But once I start losing it, it's a slippery slope. It just, it's one of those old Warner Brother cartoons that everything just goes downhill right away, I was thinking about what you were saying about, especially with kids, and how, they also want whatever they see they want it right away. They want to eat things. They want to get things quickly. And we all have that little child in us and causes a lot of problems for us. And sometimes we have to just, you know, tell the child, okay, hold on, you know, back off a little bit. It's okay. You will still get that thing, but you have to back off a little bit. And that sort of thing is starting to emerge and starting to make sense now a little bit. It's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Sure. Yeah, I think, so I hear a few different themes there. I think one theme is seeing things just as they are, right? Things as it is. Seeing the reality of what you're faced with and facing that reality of, hey, I want this thing. It's causing me pain. Really just owning it, you know, and there's a time when we may not actually want to own it, you know, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, sort of taking that, seeing what that skillful action is, that balance, mm-hmm. and then being able to execute on that balance. They're all steps, you know, and having compassion for ourselves as we learn to execute and adjust course. So there's a lot there of what you just said. A good summary of skillful action.
Just, you brought up the simple life and taking care of your grandchild, and I was thinking about those things because this is what it is, that you have to keep a sense of balance too, just to keep everything together, and this is a hard one to do, you know.
That's right.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's KANNONDO.ORG.